Hello, I'm Dr. Judy Huang, cerebrovascular neurosurgeon at Johns Hopkins.
And I'm Elizabeth Tracy. Thank you so much for joining me today. I think we should start first by talking of cerebrovascular neurosurgeon. Sounds like a lot of medicalese right off the bat to me.
It means that I focus on treating diseases that involve the blood supply to the brain. A lot of times that means blood vessel problems, such as aneurysms, which are like balloons that grow from normal vessels. It also means problems such as AVMs, or arterial venous malformations, which are abnormal tangles of blood vessels in the brain. This specialty also incorporates other types of problems that involve blood vessels that carry blood to the brain, can also involve other types of malformations that may bleed in the brain. So it is a rather wide spectrum of diseases.
When we take a look, if we surveyed the whole field of neurosurgery, what percentage of problems would be blood vessel related?
Probably a minority, actually. These do not tend to be common disorders. The main issue is that these disorders tend to affect people in the prime of their lives. So it may actually affect people during the productive working years, in their 40s or 50s. In the case of AVMs, even people in young adulthood.
When we talk about aneurysms and AVMs, I'd like to explore both of those just a little bit more. I think I was recently educated that aneurysms are something that can actually develop over the course of someone's lifetime, not necessarily something that they're born with.
Correct. Even though the understanding is that perianeurysms are present very early in one's life, I don't think that it's necessarily true that people are born with the aneurysm. There are instances when we've had imaging studies from patients for some other reason was found not to have any aneurysms and then subsequent to that presented with an aneurysm. So we know that it's an acquired lesion. We do think that there is a genetic basis to that weakness in the wall of the blood vessels, such that perhaps at birth there is a natural weakness in the wall, for example, that later on develops into a full-fledged aneurysm. Whether that's a familial predisposition or a insult such as cigarette smoking, it's variable in different people.
So if someone knows that they have a family history of aneurysms, should they be more suspicious that they too may develop such a condition?
Yes. And we define family history as actually two first-degree relatives who are affected with cerebral aneurysms. And then that would be considered a family history, and they should be more suspicious and consider getting screened beginning at age 40.
I would like you to comment just a little bit on the genetic tendency toward the development of AVMs.
There is no well-established genetic tendency. There's no reason to screen other family members, for example. There is not something that's well established.
So since you mentioned screening, let's go back then to the idea of screening for aneurysms if you have two first-degree relatives who have had them.
I recommend every 5 years a screening beginning at the age of 40, every 5 years with a brain MRA or CTA. These are less invasive modalities of detecting a blood vessel-related problem.
We would also say that it's really important to keep blood pressure under control, not smoke cigarettes and so forth.
Precisely. And avoidance of high-risk behaviors such as drug use, like cocaine, and drugs that elevate one's blood pressure.
Is there some peculiarity of the blood vessel system in the brain that allows aneurysms to develop when we don't see that same kind of a situation occurring in too many other places in the body?
There are other places in the body that typically form aneurysms, the aorta being the primary one. Aneurysms forming in the brain are just particularly devastating because of the impact that a bleed may have in the brain. So it's not that the blood vessels themselves are more likely.
Let's distinguish these things then from AVMs or arteriovenous malformations. Now, those are something that people are born with.
That's correct. Even though they're not typically discovered until young adulthood, those lesions are definitely congenital, meaning people are born with them. They may present in a variety of ways, such as headaches or seizures, or they can be completely asymptomatic for a long time.
You just brought up the next issue that I'd like to talk about, and that's detection. How are these things normally detected?
Excellent question. Oftentimes, the incidental discovery occurs when somebody gets a scan for an unrelated reason, like a headache that not particularly severe is worrisome, or some dizziness, or they may be involved in a car accident of some kind where they get a scan. A lot of times, it's really for an unrelated reason, and these are detected by surprise.
So back into the this issue of aneurysms for a second. We know that strokes or cerebrovascular accidents are pretty common, very devastating circumstances.
Yes.
About 20%, is that right, of strokes are hemorrhagic or bleeding in nature. Is this because of aneurysms such as the one you've described?
Yes. One of the more common causes of hemorrhagic stroke is bleeding from an aneurysm or an AVM. Those bleeds tend to happen in deep locations of the brain, locations that are not very accessible for surgical evacuation because there's a risk of injury to the surrounding normal brain in order to get there. Here at Hopkins, we are one center that's participating in a multi-center trial to look at a less invasive surgical technique, and that is to use our neuronavigational systems to actually plan the optimal place to put a small burr hole that's about the size of a dime into the skull, to be able to put a catheter directly into the blood clot and draw out the blood. After we draw out the blood that's there, we put in a medication called TPA to try to dissolve the blood more and be able to withdraw the liquefied blood. We're hoping to demonstrate that this technique results in better outcomes. This is still a clinical trial underway.
So let's talk about repair. Now you've detected this thing, maybe you've detected it incidentally, and maybe it's producing some symptoms, but not things that are necessarily troublesome for the patient. Now what?
So with aneurysms in particular, the risk of bleeding is taken into account over the course of the patient's lifetime. We look at patient characteristics such as their overall health, their age, ability to tolerate treatment, and we also consider aneurysm characteristics such as the location of the aneurysm, the size of the aneurysm, whether or not it's irregularly shaped. Take those factors into consideration and weigh what treatment options are best for the individual patient. Repair is always preferred because it eliminates the risk of an unforeseen catastrophe in the form of a bleed over the patient's remaining years. There are various treatment options. The gold standard of treatment of unruptured aneurysms still is microsurgical clipping. However, if the patient is older and has a lot of medical conditions that may make their recovery more prolonged, there is an excellent option in the form of endovascular therapy.
So of those two, if all things were equal, which would you prefer?
It really does depend on patient characteristics, aneurysm characteristics, and each treatment modality. There are a number of centers around the country, Johns Hopkins being one of them, where both treatment modalities are readily available for every patient. Therefore, a team of experts can make individualized and tailored therapy for each particular patient.
All things being equal, would it be better to have an endovascular approach or an open surgical approach?
It's not a matter of which one is better. It's a matter of choosing which one is better for a particular patient. Endovascular therapy for carotid artery stenosis, the large North American trial results just came out recently, which really doesn't show any superiority of carotid artery stenting over the traditional carotid endarterectomy in terms of preventing neurologic events. Yes, there is some potential benefit in decreasing the number of heart-related events, but there's no difference in stroke prevention. Does that mean we should get rid of it? No, doesn't, because there are certain high-risk patients that may benefit from something endovascular as opposed to the traditional endarterectomy. I don't want to say one treatment is better than the other because it's really a complementary strategy as opposed to mutually exclusive.
Is this kind of surgery necessarily urgent, or does a patient have a little bit of time to evaluate what some of the options might be?
Yes. In the case of incidentally discovered aneurysms that have not caused a seizure or a cranial nerve problem or some kind of neurologic manifestation, there is time to consider options and to be thoroughly evaluated. And that takes a couple of weeks. There is time. In contrast, people who come in with a bleed, otherwise known as a subarachnoid hemorrhage, from a ruptured aneurysm, their evaluation, treatment planning, and implementation of treatment happens on a very urgent basis, really within the first few hours of arriving.
Besides these two conditions, which I really emphasized, what other ones would you like to talk about within this scope of cerebrovascular surgery?
Okay, so we touched upon arterial venous malformations. These are even more rare than aneurysms. Again, they can present in a variety of different ways. This is another instance where a multifaceted and multidisciplinary approach is actually ideal for treating lesions like this because, again, no two patients are the same. because they present in different ways and the architecture of the AVM is very different. Some can be located in easily accessible areas of the brain. There are some that are located in very deep regions of the brain. There are some that are quite large, some are quite small. The different options for treatment range from only radiosurgery, which means highly focused radiation to obliterate the AVM, to a combination of endovascular embolization and microsurgical resection, or even radiosurgery. The benefit is having all those different strategies at one's disposal to utilize so that the best plan can be implemented for a particular patient. Each patient requires something different. And here at Hopkins, we are equipped to be able to handle these problems with as little risk to the patient as possible and with as best of an outcome as feasible.
Wonderful. Thank you so very much.
Thank you very much.